This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new hit sitcom, Abbott Elementary, about the teachers in a majority black, under-resourced elementary school, was created by my guest, Quinta Brunson, who also stars on the show. Before getting her own show, she was known for her viral short videos and series on the internet, like The Girl Who's Never Been on a Nice Date. She was a producer and actor for BuzzFeed Video and was a cast member on the first season of a black lady sketch show. In Abbott Elementary, she plays a second-grade teacher in a Philadelphia school. She's pretty new at the job and has remained fired up by idealism, but is still pretty naive. The series is a mockumentary. In this scene from episode one, she's in front of the camera describing herself. What she says is interspersed with a scene from her classroom. She's given her students to the count of three to do what she's told them to do. She's already up to eight when this scene begins.
I'm Janine Teagues. I've been teaching second grade here at Abbott Elementary for a year now. Eight, nine. As a product of the Philadelphia school system, I'm proud to say I survived and now teach here today. All right, guys, so there have been three presidents since this one, okay? It's an old book. So here's where I taped in the others. I'd say the main problem in the school district is, yeah, no money. The city says there isn't any, but they're doing a multi-million dollar renovation to the Eagle Stadium down the street from here. But we just make do. I mean, the staff here is incredible. They're all amazing teachers. I really look up to them all. Well, I look up to the older ones. We younger teachers are still getting the hang of it if we don't end up leaving. Look, I know this school is rough, but I became a teacher to make sure students come out alive. And after learning a lot in my first year, I finally feel on top of things. Jamal, what are you doing?
I had to go, and the toilets don't work.
And the rug was plan B.
Yeah, that scene ends with Jamal peeing on the rug in the classroom because the toilets are broken. And the chaos we heard in the middle of that scene when she was talking about the young teachers having a hard time. What we saw, which you can't see on the radio, is one teacher using an extinguisher to put out a fire in a trash can, another teacher ducking from things being thrown around the room by students, including a globe, and another teacher who's given up and walked out, carrying her things in a box while giving the school the finger. Quinta Brunson, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this series. Thank you for making it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so cool to hear you like describe the scenes that are happening. It makes it funnier to me, you describing what's happening in the show. It's so crazy.
So why did you want to do a series about a new teacher in an elementary school?
I wanted to do a series about public schools because I was visiting my mother one day. She is a now retired teacher, but at the time she wasn't. It was the year before she retired. I went to go visit her while she had a parent-teacher night that she had to be at for her school. And I was in my mother's kindergarten class. I was a student at the school where she taught for 5 years after that. But I just got to look at it in this different light. I got to see this woman who had loved this job for so many years, so much so that she didn't even want to give it up, still love it this much, despite it getting harder, despite, you know, teachers not having all the support they need, despite kids growing even more unruly than they've been in recent time. She still loved the job so much so that her and I got into a little argument about her needing to retire soon. And I just thought that was the beauty right there. That was the message. The comedy was filling itself out. But the beauty is someone being so resilient for a job that is so underpaid and so underappreciated because it makes them feel fulfilled and like they're doing their purpose here.
So your mother was your teacher in kindergarten?
She was. Yep. I was only four. I started school early at four or five. And to me, it was just my norm. You know, I went to school with my mom. You know, she made me breakfast in the morning at home, and then we went to school. And I called her mom. I think she didn't require me to call her Miss Brunson. I did call her mom, but she treated me exactly equal to the rest of the kids, which is one thing I remember from that time. And it just felt like a continuing of the nourishment and nurture I got at home.
One of my favorite characters on the show is a middle-aged, very experienced Black teacher who so easily gets the students to listen to her. And she's more cynical than your character, not about the children or about teaching, but about the ability to get resources. But I love those teachers who just have that kind of magic touch, and the kids respect her and listen to her and will do what she says. And while chaos might be happening all around, her students will not be in chaos. How do they do it? I've always wondered, how do they do it?
I don't know. You know, my mother has that ability. And that character, Barbara Howard, is loosely based on my mother. It's something I've watched her do for years and continue to do, to just get a room of children to act right with nothing more than a look. I just think it's a gift. You know, one interesting thing about it is I think my mother has just as much respect for her students as they do for her. And I think that relationship creates a bond. And I think that's very important. That's an important part of that power.
You started as a comic, and I know that you're very short. I should say I'm very short, too. Do you want to compare height?
Yeah, let's do it. I didn't know you were short.
Oh, yeah, I'm short. You couldn't tell by my voice. So
No. Or your pictures.
Yeah. So I'm 4'11",
We are the same height.
Take, maybe. Okay, right. So, when I'm in front of a microphone, I have to stand on something. If there's a podium in front of me, I need something to raise me so that you see more than a forehead sticking up. When you started in stand-up, were you self-conscious about being short, that people wouldn't be able to see you over other people's heads, or that, you know, that you wouldn't have enough, command on stage because you weren't, physically overbearing?
You know what? No. For most of my life, I did not feel self-conscious about being short. If anything, I looked at it as a superpower. It was something very interesting about me, and people thought I was cute and funny. And when I started doing stand-up, it was just another thing to be funny about. I feel like I've become more aware of it recently. Recently, I'm like, man, I am not giving grown woman to people. They think... I kind of would like to give full grown adult, but it's not giving that. And now that I'm in this space of, producer, showrunner, I want to appear as big as I feel on the inside. Just not sure I do.
Oh, I know what you mean from my experiences. But you have a really funny joke about being short. I'd rather you tell it, but you're not going to know the one I mean. Maybe if I say this, the one about how you disappoint people when they find out you're really an adult. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Terry, why would you bring that joke up? That's a controversial joke.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, stop telling that joke because some people thought that it was...
So people aren't going to know what we're talking about. So can we tell the joke? And
yeah, you go ahead.
I'll tell the joke. Okay, so your joke is, the worst thing about being short is disappointing child predators when they find out.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm not good at telling jokes. So I killed your joke, but people don't want you to tell it anyways.
That's okay. It was already dead. It had happened to me at a bar here in LA where I live. There was a man who, first of all, bar. So, right, I'm an adult. You know that already. But he told me just straight up when I told him that I was 25, he went, "Oh, I thought you were younger." And I was like, "Excuse me?" And he was like, "Well, you look like about 17, 18. And I'm just like, "Do you hear yourself?" and this man has not a care in the world. He doesn't care about what he's saying. You know, he doesn't care that it's awful. He's letting me know that I have disappointed him in being 25 at the time.
How old was he?
He was, I don't know how old he was. I didn't ask him, but he looked well into his 30s. Well into his 30s for sure.
Did you write the joke after that experience?
Yeah, I did. I wrote it after that. And I had a friend who I would walk around with, Christine, who was about the same height as me. So we would both kind of get this energy. often. So it's funny, you know, people don't like the joke and that's fine and thought it was in poor taste, which might be true, but it is something that did happen to me before and in different ways. And same thing with my friend Christine.
So how do you feel about having to edit out a joke because some people think it's in poor taste, but other people probably think it's pretty funny? I think it could be a hard choice to make.
I think it's a hard choice to make. I think it's an individual choice to make. You know, right now, I mean, we're seeing a reckoning of, specifically with stand-up, you know, with what's okay to say and what's not. And I think the reason why the hammer comes down so hard on stand-up is because it's an individualized sport. It's one person on that stage. You have one person to aim your frustrations at if you don't like the joke. I'll watch stand-up, and I'll cringe at something someone says and be like, ugh, oof, that's in poor taste. I don't like that joke. But I just remember to make the distinction in my mind that that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It doesn't mean that it's not true. It doesn't mean it's not how that person feels, and it doesn't mean that's not how a part of the world is thinking, you know, or interacting. So I think it's an individual choice. If someone tells me that they just really don't like something that I've said, I'll assess how much I want to fight for said thing. And if I don't want to fight that much for it, then I'm not going to. You know, like that joke, for instance, I wasn't going to fight for things that make people that uncomfortable. That's just not where my energy lies as a person who aims to make funny things.
I want to ask you more about your schooling, especially since you're the creator of the series Abbott Elementary. You went to what you describe as an unconventional and progressive school where the curriculum centered on Black history and all aspects of education. So what grades was this, and would you describe the school?
Yeah, so this was first through fifth grade. At any given time, there maybe were about 200 to 300 kids in this program total from first to fifth grade. And you know, you stayed until you graduated and more kids came in until the program was shut down.
What do you think you learned about Black history that students in public schools were not being taught?
Yeah, I mean, for us, Black history was bled into every single subject we learned. There was nothing that didn't start with the conversation of a Black person's role in whatever it is we were studying, whether it be math or science or French or geography. It either started with African people and their place in engineering and earth and science, or it started with how Black people came to this country via the slave trade and what that meant for things like Wall Street and you know, our place in this world. And no lesson started without the root of where Blackness was a part of it.
When you went to public school and met a lot of kids who didn't go to this school that you went to, were you surprised that they didn't have that perspective on the role of Black people in math and French and science and literature?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still surprised to this day. I have friends who have gone to college and don't know what I learned in first grade, you know? Like, I remember when Hidden Figures came out, it was a really big deal. And everyone was like, whoa, Black women. I'm like, no one got that in first grade? You guys didn't learn that when you... or for instance, which is so funny, this was my funniest, you know, thing from that time. You know, in first grade, all the other kids were watching like Disney movies on Friday. We watched Amistad, and I was just like,
that's a heavy film.
It's just like, it's a heavy film. But our teachers didn't believe in keeping the heavy away from us, right? They believed that we would be best prepared if we knew what the world was. It's interesting because now there's all this conversation of critical race theory, right? And you know, I see all these people who are afraid of it and what it'll do. It's like, but for me, it didn't even make me angry as a child. I'm telling you, it just told me my history and that was it. It prepared me for the world. It prepared me for what had happened, what could happen, and what I hope doesn't happen, and what I want to never happen again. And it just the truth. It was just the facts.
You write in your memoir that you had a cousin from West Philly who was shot to death while crossing the street. And at this time in your life, you were living in L.A. I think you'd probably not lived there for long. And it was, I think, devastating for you to be so far away when this happened. And, you know, you've spoken of how when you started, like, rebelling against your mother's, like, strict rules, you were, like, living two lives, the life that you lived at home and then the life that you lived on campus at Temple University and the life that you lived when you moved out to L.A. You were reluctant to talk to your L.A. friends about what happened to your cousin. Can you talk about why you were uncomfortable bringing it up, like what your concerns were? And I'll preface this by saying I'm very sorry to have read about your cousin. What an awful thing to happen in your family and to your cousin.
Well, my cousin, Tyrese, that did happen to him. And it was uncomfortable to talk about because, you know, here in L.A., at the time I was working at BuzzFeed, and, you know, I was in the land of fun and sunshine. And for me, that experience felt very unique to living in Philadelphia, to being a young Black woman from Philadelphia even. And yes, gun violence can and does affect everyone, but by proximity and for many, many reasons, it hurts my community often. And gun violence to me just felt so specific to me and specific to home. And I didn't want to share that hurt with people who didn't understand it. When I was back home in Philly, the way that, you know, we talk about gun violence as it affects our communities is different. There's an understanding there. There's a love there. There's an understanding of the makeup of our city and of our families and our communities where the love is not absent. And we have an understanding of why these things happen. We may not be talking about it in a super, pinpoint, here are the facts, statistics, and data stuff, but you just know it because you're from there. But talking about it to anyone else, I mean, to be honest, even talking about it to you, I don't know that you know that much about intracommunal gun violence past what you've read somewhere. And it just feels uncomfortable, you know? And it's one of those weird things. I talk about it with my friends from Philly. It's like, well, how do we stop it if we don't talk about it more or bring it to a larger platform? But at the same time, we feel uncomfortable. It's so between us and between our worlds. But I think I'm landing on the idea that, like, we just have to talk about it because the same gun issues we're talking about when someone brings a gun and shoots up a mall or when somebody brings a gun and shoots up a school, they overlap with what's happening in communities. And so while it's uncomfortable, it's something, which is why I chose to write about it in the book, I think it deserves the attention of this country because it's happening in this country.
I know we're out of time, but I'm wondering, what's it like for you now to have power and money? I mean, the show is a real hit. I mean, it's something you really have to think about now. You have different kinds of decisions, and you just have a different place in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I have a big, large family to take care of, so I'm taking care of my family. With the power part, I don't know. I'm still examining what that means for me. I don't know how much I've liked the idea of that, but that doesn't mean it's not the case. So a lot of times it's about how I can be a good leader, how I can hopefully continue to maintain a positive work environment on Abbott. You know, there's like somewhere close to 300 people who work on the show. I want to continue to be a good leader of this group. That's something I have to do and maintain a good work environment. And it's also about, I guess so far it's about managing, what to do with this newfound attention. You know, for instance, one of the decisions that we made as a group with the studio and the network was instead of marketing the show, we're doing well, right? And hopefully I don't regret this, but we're doing well. We have very good ratings. People are watching the show. It was like, well, how about we put this marketing money towards something else? And we chose to put the marketing money towards supplies for teachers, you know? And it's about being able to make those kind of decisions that really excite me. Things that can really materially help people. And I think other than that, you know, I've been prepared for this for a long time. And so I'm just going to keep doing what I have been doing.
Well, congratulations on the series. And I just want to say, you know, as somebody who got fired after 6 weeks teaching eighth grade, I have such respect and I'm in such awe of teachers who really know how to do it and who create like safe, respectful environments for their students where their students can really thrive and learn. And I'm grateful to you, not only for providing like a really and just totally enjoyable, funny, entertaining series, but for creating those kinds of teachers who each in their own way create or are learning to create that kind of environment where their children can really benefit. So, you know, thank you for all of that.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed the show and thank you for watching and for interviewing me.
Oh, my pleasure. Quinta Brunson created and stars in the new hit ABC sitcom Abbott Elementary. Jazz pianist Lenny Tristano didn't make many commercial recordings or perform so often in nightclubs, but at home in New York, he taught hundreds of students and recorded myriad hours of his own music. A new box set digs deep into Tristano's private stash of home and live recordings. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Lenny Tristano getting down with the blues, earthy music at odds with his reputation for being a coolly analytical improviser who was a little above it all. His favorite pianist and big influence was bebop giant Bud Powell, but Lenny leaned into longer, busier lines. You could hear the Bach he'd studied come out when he got really busy. He can sound like his right hand is a harpsichord and his left is a jazzy walking bass, two streams flowing together. Lenny Tristano in the early 1960s, from the 6-CD box Personal Recordings, 1946 to 1970, co-produced by the labels Dot Time and the Webb Waterhouse Mosaic Records. The selection, by daughter Carol Tristano, aims to show Lenny had more moods than he may get credit for. He could also sound playful and relaxed, letting the music breathe. In this new box drawn from Lenny Tristano's home recordings and live dates, he plays in solo, duo, trio, quartet, quintet, and sextet settings. It all starts in 1946 when his core players start joining up, namely guitarist Billy Bauer and like-minded saxophonists Warren Marsh on tenor and Lee Konitz on alto. Here they all are at Carnegie Hall in 1949. Thank you. Konitz. I've buried the lead in this review. What really has Tristano fans buzzing about these basement tapes is a trove of free improvisations Lenny and company recorded at home in 1948. That was a year before his studio tracks, sometimes identified as the first free jazz on record, although saxophonist Bud Freeman and drummer Ray McKinley had beat them to it in 1945 with the duet The Atomic Era. Tristano's newly unearthed quartet improvisations are fascinating despite the poor sound quality caught on a wire recorder. Free jazz can be rambunctious, but these musicians step and listen carefully. You can hear the Bach behind it, one instrumental voice imitating another. Even better than those seven free pieces for quartet, we also hear Tristano's sextet slip a more confident free improvisation into a 1950 nightclub gig without shocking the audience in the slightest. Their free play is as orderly as their jamming on standard chord progressions. Most of the music in the new Lenny Tristano box was recorded at his home. Jazz is a social music, so working from home has its disadvantages, not least as a career move. But Tristano left behind much valuable work for us to discover. A disc of well-recorded solo music here is a standout. Drummer Max Roach once said of Tristano, I'm paraphrasing, "We uptown black musicians and Lenny's downtown white guys admired each other and could play together no problem. But Lenny's crew had their own scene and style, different from what we were doing. It was something," Max Roach said, "that you could respect and appreciate." Tristano didn't always get his due, but by now listeners have come around. Jazz does, after all, have a soft spot for maverick pianists who plow their own furrow, trusting that someday the public will catch up.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed Lenny Tristano, Personal Recordings, 1946 to 1970. My guest, Julie Otsuka, is an acclaimed novelist who's drawn on her experiences as a Japanese-American. Before I tell you about her new novel, let me tell you about her first two. When the Emperor Was Divine is based on the experiences of her mother, uncle, and grandparents when they were forced into Japanese-American incarceration camps during World War II. Her book, The Buddha in the Attic, which won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, is a historical novel about the women known as picture brides. These were women in the early 20th century who emigrated to America from Japan the only way they legally could, by marrying a man who was already living here. Working through matchmakers, the would-be husbands and wives knew each other only from photos. When the women arrived and met their future husbands, they typically realized they were deceived in one way or another. Otsuka's new novel, The Swimmers, starts off in a pool where people go for temporary escape from their problems. One of the women is in the early stages of dementia. In the second half of the novel, her dementia has progressed to the point where she's in a facility. Her daughter, who's in her 40s and has been geographically and emotionally distant, returns to see her mother. Otsuka takes inventory of the disappeared and remaining memories, describes life in a facility after living with a husband for 40 years in a 3-bedroom home, and considers the daughter's sense of guilt. As you'll hear, Otsuka has a very distinctive style of writing. Julie Otsuka, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your writing, so I'm very glad you're here. I want to start with a reading from the first page of The Swimmers, your new novel, because I want our listeners to hear your style of writing and how the accumulation of detail just kind of keeps building through the book. So would you read the opening for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The pool is located deep underground in a large cavernous chamber many feet beneath the streets of our town. Some of us come here because we are injured and need to heal. We suffer from bad backs, fallen arches, shattered dreams, broken hearts, anxiety, melancholia, anhedonia, the usual above-ground afflictions. Others of us are employed at the college nearby and prefer to take our lunch breaks down below, in the waters, far away from the harsh glares of our colleagues and screens. Some of us come here to escape, if only for an hour, our disappointing marriages on land. Many of us live in the neighborhood and simply love to swim. One of us, Alice, a retired lab technician now in the early stages of dementia, comes here because she always has.
Talk with us a little bit about this almost inventory style of writing that you have, where it's almost like lists and paragraph form, you know, just like details that keep building and building into a larger picture. And I find myself when I read your writing going, yeah, yeah, that's right. Oh, I know that. Yes. Oh, that's so true. it's like this checklist of things that I know, but I haven't necessarily expressed.
That's funny. I don't aim to be a list maker, but I think that my way of apprehending the world is actually through detail. I think that's just how I put together the big picture. I think that's just what my brain kind of naturally wants to do when trying to figure things out. So I wasn't even aware that that's what I was doing. I'm not really a plot-driven writer, and my background is in the arts, so I'm interested in looking at things as if for the first time and not knowing which details are necessarily important and which are not, but just taking them all in and kind of seeing what the gestalt is.
So as we heard in the reading, one of the swimmers, Alice, is in the early stages of dementia. And as the novel progresses, she loses more and more of her memory until she's moved to a facility. Your mother died of dementia-related causes. Was it frontotemporal dementia like in the book?
It was. And it was Pick's disease, which is a form of frontotemporal dementia.
Yeah, in the book, you describe it as being very rare. What is it? How does it compare to Alzheimer's, just so we understand what's going on?
Well, for one thing, the onset can be much, much earlier. So I think for my mother, she might have even manifested symptoms in her 50s, definitely in her 60s. Although I think it was hard for us to realize what was her and what was her disease, especially in the early years before she was even diagnosed. But with Pick's disease, you often get changes in personality, and the decline can be, for my mother, it was much, much slower. I think her decline took place over at least 20 years. But I think the personality change is probably the main difference from people with Alzheimer's.
Could you tell that it was happening? Because that's one of the questions in the book. For example, like a crack appears in the pool that the swimmers go to, and the people wonder, you know, many of us remain anxious because the truth is we don't know what it is or what it means or if it has any meaning at all. Maybe the crack is just a crack, nothing more, nothing less. Maybe it's a rupture, a chasm. How deep is it? Who's to blame for it? Can we reverse it? And most importantly, why us? It's no coincidence, I'm sure, that those questions are the questions we ask when symptoms begin to appear, like, does this have any meaning? Is it serious? Is it nothing? Am I exaggerating? If it's a problem, like what or who is to blame for it? And, you know, and why me? Why us? Why is this happening to us?
I think it's sometimes hardest for the people closest to the person who's suffering from dementia to see what is happening. I think there's a lot of denial going on probably in the early years. But I remember actually the first time that I realized something was slightly off is I think I went home one year for Christmas, and my mother was always very, very good with her hands, and we were baking these crescent cookies, and they just didn't look right on the baking sheet. You know, they were not neat little crescent rolls, which is what she would have made before. So that was like a very clear visual representation that something was not right. but I don't think we really questioned her repeating herself early on. It just seemed like one of her quirks or something that maybe she was even doing intentionally. And I wish actually that we realized earlier that the way she was behaving, it wasn't something that she, you know, had any real control over. But, you know, it took us a long time to I think, before we even brought her into a neurologist to get a diagnosis. I think it took many, many years.
What would have been different had you gotten an earlier diagnosis? It's not like it's irreversible.
Nothing, probably nothing. Although, I guess the one thing that could have been different is that we might have had a little bit more compassion for her early on.
That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. It's difficult to live with somebody whose personality is changing and is, you know, at a certain point, they're not the person that you remember. But they can't help it. But I think it took us a long time to realize that.
You know, in the novel, when so many memories are starting to disappear, one of the things the mother remembers is being sent to a Japanese-American incarceration camp when she was young, when she was a child. Did your mother hang on to that memory when others were disappearing?
She did. Those memories for her were very strong. They remain with her till, you know, till close to the end of her life. And I think it's probably because they're childhood memories and those are the memories that stay with you the longest. But, you know, I remember one day she just began to tell a story about her last day of school at Lincoln Elementary in Berkeley.
Before being forced into the camp?
The day before they had to leave, yeah. And she just began to tell that story over and over and over again. And I hadn't heard that story before. I mean, perhaps my father had, I'm not sure. But
what was the story?
That her teacher asked her to stand up and then told everyone in the class that Haruko was my mother's Japanese name, would be leaving the next day. And would they please tell her goodbye? So the entire class said goodbye to her, which I think was probably an act of kindness. But she felt very singled out and very ashamed and embarrassed.
Did the teacher explain why she was going away?
You know, I don't know. It's a really good question. I wish that I'd asked my mother that when she was still lucid. I don't know. I mean, I often wonder, what did that teacher say to her students? Did they wonder why their Japanese classmates were suddenly disappeared? And, you know, I've traveled a lot for, especially for my first novel, and I've spoken to people who were alive during World War II. And I remember one woman, a white woman, who had been, I think, in junior high during World War II. And she just said, you know, one day her classmate, who was a good friend of hers, was there, and the next day she was gone, and she didn't know what had happened to her. So I don't know what was told to the children back then. I don't know what their parents told to them either. It's a good question.
In the novel, you write, she remembers to warn her daughter at the end of every phone call that the FBI will check up on you soon.
Yes.
How does the FBI figure into your family's story?
My grandfather was arrested by the FBI on December 8th, 1941, so the day after Pearl Harbor was bombed. He went to work. He worked for a Japanese-owned mercantile company, and he never came home. So he was sent to a series of detention camps run by the Department of Justice. These were different from the regular camps where, you know, for the camp where my mother was sent was a different kind of camp. And he was considered a dangerous enemy alien, and my mother didn't see him for about 2.5 years.
Was he considered a serious enemy alien because he worked for a Japanese company?
He was a leader in the Japanese American community, a business leader, so he was fairly prominent. So those were the men who were rounded up first. All the leaders of the community were taken away, so the Japanese American community was really kind of emasculated and left leaderless. So he was one of many who were taken away in that first roundup.
Did you get to meet him or your grandmother?
He died when I was 8, and my grandmother, she lived to be almost 101, so I knew her for many, many years. And my memories of him are as a very, very gentle man. He never talked about what had happened to himself during the war. But I think I was too young to even know what my mother had gone through at the age of 8. So I remember he was always reading. He had these Japanese-English dictionaries, and he would just underline words in red pencil. He was always learning. And my grandmother, she had you know, she had more stories to tell, but I couldn't. Her English was all right, but as she got older, it degraded. So I wasn't always able to communicate with her as well as I would have wanted to. She was a tough lady. She went through so much. I mean, she really kept the family together after the war when they came home to Berkeley. She just went through a lot. She's a survivor.
Was your grandfather able to work after being called a traitor?
No.
Is traitor the right word, or an enemy alien, I think is what you said.
Yeah, no, they're synonymous, I think, or at least in the eye of the government. The reason that he was not able to work after the war was not necessarily because of what he'd been labeled, but it was because he really lost his health. We don't know exactly what happened to him in the camps where he was imprisoned, but he had three strokes when he came home. So he was not in good health. So he was unable to support the family. So my grandmother went to work as a maid for wealthy white families up in the Berkeley Hills and supported the family. And she, up until right before the war, had been, you know, a fairly well-off middle-class housewife. She didn't have to work. But they lost all of their money, so they really had to start all over again.
So there wasn't much you were able to learn from your grandparents. What about your mother? How old was she when she was incarcerated, and what stories did she tell?
Yeah, actually, I want to say one thing I did learn from my grandfather, but years later, after he died, was that we found this cache of letters that he'd written to his wife and children during the first year of the war in my grandmother's fireplace that she wanted to burn the day before we were moving her out of her house and into a residence for the elderly. And so that was the first time that I learned a little bit about what it was that he'd gone through during his experience of imprisonment during the war. But my mother, she would occasionally mention camp, but when I was very young, I didn't know what kind of camp she was talking about. I actually thought she was describing some sort of summer camp because that was really my only point of reference. But there were objects around the house from camp. So I remember we had these old forks that we kept in the back of the silverware drawer. And on each handle, there was my family's government-issued ID number. And so we only used those forks when all the good forks were dirty and in the dishwasher, and we never used those forks with company. And it wasn't until I was a little bit older that I began to want to know more about what it was that my mother had gone through. And when I actually began to write my first novel, she was in the early stages of her dementia. And she was, because her childhood memories were fairly accurate for a while, I could ask her a lot of questions. And then at a certain point, I could not.
When your family came back after the war was over, did they still have their home?
They did. They were very fortunate because most Japanese could not own property by law. So, but my grandfather, I think he bought his home in his children's name, and they were American-born and therefore U.S. citizens. So I think the deed was in their name, and then maybe when they turned 18, they could pass it over to him. And the house had been paid for, so they actually had, unlike most families, they had a home to return to. I mean, there was a housing shortage after the war, so many Japanese-Americans who returned from the camps just had no place to live, so they would live in hostels, or there were these makeshift trailer camps. It was very, very difficult, but they had their home, but it had just been completely trashed. Many things had been stripped from that house, but it was theirs.
So I want you to read another paragraph from your book, and this is about, you know, wondering what caused the dementia. Was it something in the environment, something we did? And this is also written in the style that you become known for, which is an accumulation of details that paint a larger picture and are very just kind of revealing in their specificity. So if you could read this paragraph for us.
What was it, you wonder, that first made her begin to forget? Was it the chemical and the hair dye that once turned her scalp bright red for 2 weeks? Was it something toxic in the hairspray, Aquanet, that she used two and sometimes three times a day for more than 30 years. "Hold your breath," she'd say, as she pressed down on the nozzle and disappeared beneath a cloud of cold white mist. Was it the Raid that she sprayed all over the kitchen counter the minute she saw an ant? Was it sporadic, genetic, a series of mini-strokes, something in the drinking water, the aluminum-laden antiperspirant? Too little sleep, she had been complaining about your father snoring ever since the day they got married. Too much TV? A dearth of hobbies? Hobbies, she once said to you. Who has time for hobbies? Should she have eaten more blueberries, less butter, read more books, read even one book? You don't remember ever seeing her read a single book, although there was always, piled high on her nightstand, beside the mountain of stray socks, a stack of books she meant to read. "I'm okay, you're okay. How to talk to your teenager, teach yourself French in 1 week. Was it the hormone replacement after menopause? The estradiol, the Provera, the high blood pressure, the medication for the high blood pressure, her undiagnosed thyroid condition, the deep and lingering depression she fell into the year after her mother died, 3 days shy of 101. Now what am I supposed to do, she'd said. Was it you?
Thanks for reading that. That's Julie Otsuka reading from her new novel, The Swimmers. Julie Otsuka, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Julie Otsuka's new novel is called The Swimmers. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Al Banks. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.